Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Diplomatic crises come and go, but even if Washington and Jerusalem get past the harsh words and canceled trips of the past week, things have reportedly been said that are hard to take back. Talk that ally Israel is harming U.S. interests, maybe costing U.S. lives. Even the Pentagon has gotten in on the act. It's a rough moment in the special relationship. This hour on Point, American interests and the blow-up with Israel. You can join the conversation. What just happened here? Was it overblown? A moment of truth? Will it matter long-term? And do the interests of Israel and the United States still align? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear in a moment from former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, and from New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent, David Sanger. But we go first today to author and journalist Mark Perry, whose report in Foreign Policy put the issue of the Pentagon's interest in this issue in public in an unusual way. Perry's book, Talking to Terrorists, won the National Jewish Book Award. He also served from 1989 to 2004 as a consultant to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. His Foreign Policy magazine piece, published online, is headlined The Petraeus Briefing. Mark Perry, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you, Tom.
So when was the briefing? What was it about? And how does it figure into the brouhaha this week, Mark?
In mid-January, some staff officers from the Central Command, General Petraeus' command in the Middle East, came to Washington, to the Pentagon, to brief the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And outside of the kind of standard PowerPoint slides of the facts of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the message was very clear from the briefers that failure to act on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to move credibly to resolve it, to the degree that we couldn't do that as a country, our credibility in the war on terror and with General Petraeus' Arab constituent countries would be harmed. And then, in fact, American military posture in the region was being eroded as a result of the lack of progress on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It was really quite a shocking briefing.
Was this a big deal? I mean, that sounds almost like what General Petraeus said in very public hearings before the Senate just this week, but you call it unprecedented. In what way?
Well, I think it was not so much a message. After after my report was published, I received calls from senior military officers who said, "What's the news here?"
Mm-hmm.
And the news is that it's so public that there's a direct tie between the lack of progress in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Israeli intransigence on that conflict, or perceived Israeli intransigence on that conflict, and and American lives in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, that there seemed to be a direct line in the briefing between the lack of progress and the kind of price that we're paying in terms of blood, but also money, in the war on terror.
You make the argument that the Pentagon's interest in this is part of what ramped up all the tensions even before Vice President Joe Biden went to Israel.
I think that's right. I was very surprised, despite the briefing, I was very surprised about the Biden trip and the way that Vice President Biden was treated in Israel. And I think that it was really that flashpoint that brought the military concern out. I was also gratified that in his testimony on Tuesday before the Senate Armed Services Committee, the first action point in his prepared remarks, General Petraeus referred to the lack of progress on the Israeli-Palestinian issue as having a negative impact on American status in the region. He made this a very explicit point, and it was his first point. So the two are tied very closely together, at least in his mind.
General Petraeus testifying this week, but of course the White House now saying that Joe Biden did not say, denying that he said, as he was quoted as saying in Israel, that this is starting to get dangerous for us, undermining this, you know, what you're doing here undermines the security of our troops. This was reported first in the Israeli press, the White House saying no, he didn't. The Israeli ambassador to the United States quoted, again, first in the Israeli press, telling consuls around the U.S., that this was the worst crisis in 35 years. He's saying very publicly today that he did not say that. Has this been misrepresented, Mark? Has this been a tempest in a teapot?
I don't think it's a tempest in a teapot, especially when General Petraeus makes the kind of remarks that he did during the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on Tuesday. I did not make the report that the Israeli press made, but subsequent to my publication, there's been confirmation of the report, and the linkages have been made again and again and again in the public press, in the Washington Post, other publications, that this is in fact the case, that there's real worry in the American military that that without progress in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, this is the perceived weakness of the United States among Arab countries will remain and might even worsen.
Is Petraeus saying we can't accomplish our mission because of this, or it would be easier if this conflict got resolved?
General Petraeus is not the kind of person who makes unilateral statements that if this doesn't happen, then this will happen. He's simply saying that it's going to be tougher for us, and that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a key issue in the Middle East. And I've spent 25 years wandering around the Middle East, from villages to refugee camps to Amman and Riyadh and foreign capitals. And everywhere you go, no matter who you talk to, it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the number one issue. It is not the war on terror that's the number one issue.
President Obama was asked by Fox News yesterday whether there the falling out, or whatever you want to call it, this last week is a crisis. He said no. He said Israel's one of our closest allies, and you know, went on to reassert that. Are we now in a papering over phase, or is this in fact an unbreakable relationship, and this is just a riffle on the surface, Mark?
I don't think there's any question that Israel's a close ally of the United States. It will remain so. I think the administration is purposely bringing down the temperature. They don't want there to be a crisis, but they want Israel to show good faith on these negotiations, and they don't like being surprised. For the vice president to land in Jerusalem and then to hear within 24 hours that there's 1,600 new apartments in East Jerusalem and that this has upset the Palestinians who aren't going to come back to the talks, that's a surprise the vice president didn't want, that the administration didn't want, and they needed to make a point that it wasn't welcome.
Mark Perry, please stand by. I want to bring Ambassador Martin Indyk into our conversation. He's currently vice president and director of foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, served as the U.S. ambassador to Israel under the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, was one of the lead negotiators at the Camp David peace talks. He's author of Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peacemaking diplomacy in the Middle East. Martin Indyk, welcome. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
What have we seen this week? What just happened here, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, I think Mark is right that this was an unpleasant surprise, but the context is of a long and laborious and painstaking effort by George Mitchell, the special Middle East envoy, to try to get negotiations going again between Netanyahu government and the Palestinian Authority under Abu Mazen. And that was delayed by the effort to try to get some understandings about settlement activity. You remember that President Obama originally asked for a full settlements freeze, including natural growth. But the deal that Mitchell put together with Netanyahu provided for a settlements moratorium for 10 months in the West Bank, but excluded building of housing in Jewish suburbs of East Jerusalem. And because it was excluded, because it was a bridge too far for Netanyahu to accept or to sell to his own government, Mitchell tried, I think, very hard to get some understandings with Netanyahu about what would not happen in Jerusalem as he got these talks underway. And the announcement of these 1,600 new housing units, the day after the proximity talks were announced, it happened to be the day that Joe Biden arrived in Israel, really created this sense that everything that had been discussed before was for naught, and we were going to be back to square one and not able to even proceed with the indirect talks.
What do you make of the reporting? Mark Perry reports that people in the Pentagon saying Mitchell is too old, too slow, and too late. But also, in the testimony of General Petraeus this week, in Mark's reporting on this briefing to the Pentagon, in some of the comments we've heard this week, the notion that Israel's interests, at least as defined by the Netanyahu government, and American interests have somehow diverged, that there's new light between them. What do you say to that, Ambassador?
Well, on the first one, I just think that's a bum rap. Mitchell is in his very approach is low and slow. He believes in the Northern Ireland template. Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the way you get it done.
Mm-hmm. Impatience with other people, but he basically his motto is 700 days of failure and one day of success. Mm-hmm. And by that count, he's only in, I think, day 368 or something. So he's got a ways to go. But that's his approach, and that's there's something to be said for that, just because there's so much mistrust and the chasm between the parties is so great that the idea that you can come somehow wave a magic American wand and solve all these problems and jump to a solution is fanciful. As far as the rest of Mark Perry's report, I think one has to be very careful here. Tom, you in your introduction and Mark also slipped into this notion that American lives are at stake here.
This has been the widely sort of played interpretation or boiling down of what Joe Biden said or was reported said and then denied having said. So I understand exactly what
the White House denies having said it. And look, there's no doubt that there's a linkage. But I think it gets to be kind of incendiary when you say that American soldiers are dying because of the failure to resolve the Palestinian conflict. That's not what Mark Perry's report said, and so I just think we need to be careful there.
But it is national security issues in a time of war. I mean, war is about shooting.
Yeah, but the connection is as follows, and this is Mark Perry's report.
Ambassador, could you hold that till just after a break? I apologize. We have to take one right here. Ambassador Martin Indyk, Mark Perry, please stand by. David Sanger will join us in a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American interests and the blow-up with Israel in recent days. Ambassador Martin Indyk is with us, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, now at the Brookings Institution, author of Innocent Abroad. Mark Perry is here, author and journalist who came out with this report in Foreign Policy magazine online about Pentagon conversations around the Middle East peace process, the lack of progress there, and its impact on American security interests in the Middle East. Ambassador Indyk, I'm sorry we had to interrupt you for the break there. Please pick it up.
Well, the point of Perry's article is that everything is connected in the Middle East. So our failure to make progress on what was President Obama's signature issue of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict affects our credibility in the rest of the region, particularly because the Palestinian issue is a hot-button issue in the Arab world and in the Muslim world. Mm. And so for the Pentagon to say, you know, it's making things more difficult, I would just say, yeah, duh, of course it does. It has for a very long time. But I was just warning that to say that this leads to loss of American lives is a stretch that the Pentagon didn't make.
Mark Perry, what about it? There is a kind of a yeah-duh element here. There's a dynamic over many years of American administrations trying to solve this Israeli-Palestinian dispute for Israel's sake, for the Palestinians and for Americans. That's not new. The costs of it are not unknown.
No, that's right, and I want to be clear here. I think if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict tomorrow were resolved tomorrow, if we could, in Ambassador Indyk's phrase, wave a magic wand, and the Israelis and Palestinians could declare peace, the war on terror wouldn't end. We would still have real problems in the Middle East. This isn't the magic bullet. However, the fact that there does seem to be paralysis in the eyes of the Arab world, that there's paralysis in this, that the United States isn't moving quickly enough, fast enough, seems to be, in their eyes, siding with Israel too much, not putting enough pressure on Israel. And these people watch Al Jazeera every day. They see the conflict on the news every day. We don't. They emphasize to General Petraeus and to his staff that this conflict is key for them and that the United States has to be perceived as being even-handed and moving credibly and quickly to resolve it. I know that we can't wave a magic wand, but we've been at this for 30 years. And the Arabs look at it this way, the Arab governments look at it this way, and they want much more credible progress than we've shown thus far.
Ambassador,
can I just
yes,
say,
please.
Tom,
yes, please.
We shouldn't get too carried away with this. You know, I mean, these are the same Arab governments that are welcoming General Petraeus' missile defenses to help protect them from Iran. These are the same Arab governments who give us full access to bases in the Gulf in order to prosecute the war in Iraq. Qatar, where Al Jazeera is based, hosts the largest American air base in the world, and they pay for it. So, I mean, yes, they want us to pressure Israel. They want us to deliver Israel. That, too, goes all the way back to the Suez Crisis when we actually did deliver Israel, and that's what they'd love us to do. But you know, the situation is complicated, and the fact that the Arabs want us to do more to help them on an issue that is very important to them is something that nobody should be surprised about. It's a reason for doing it, but we have our own reasons beyond that for trying to resolve the conflict, including to try to help secure Israel.
But quite true. At the same time, General Petraeus, I mean, right there before the Senate Armed Services Committee, went down a significant litany of American interests handicapped by the unsolved status of that conflict this week.
Well, forget about General Petraeus. General Jones, the President's National Security Advisor, said in a speech to the J Street conference six months ago, if there was one issue that he would tell the President that he had to resolve in 2010, it was the Palestinian issue. Well, so the generals feel this very, very clearly.
People are trying to get things back on an even keel here. You can hear that in a lot of statements, including from the President now. But something happened, or something broke in the open this week, Martin. And what was that? And it comes at a time when there's all the talk about a threat from Iran. It hardly seems like a propitious time for this, but maybe it's always a good time to talk. I don't know.
Well, it was two things. One is the accumulation of these kinds of incidents that have occurred over many years, usually when secretaries of state arrive in Israel or just depart Israel. There's an announcement of a new settlement or new activity that is embarrassing to American leaders and disrupts the effort to try to resolve the conflict. So I think that was part of it. It was like this was just the last straw, especially with the vice president being there and it being an insult to him. When he went there to try to embrace Israel and demonstrate to the Israeli public how much the United States supports Israel. So that's one issue that I think they wanted to try to clear up. But the second is, as I said before, the proximity talks were just announced the day before. and after trying for 10 months to try to get negotiations going again, there was a real frustration that this was going to blow the thing up all over again.
I want to bring another wise voice in here from Washington. Mark Perry, Ambassador Martin Indyk, please stand by. We're joined by David Sanger, the New York Times chief Washington correspondent, Pulitzer Prize winner. He is The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power, has been updated and is just out in paperback. David Sanger, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
What do you see in the fire and brimstone, or whatever you want to call it, this week between the U.S. and Israel?
Well, I think we've got to separate out a couple of the different issues that we've been discussing today. I completely agree with Ambassador Indyk that there is no news in the thought that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict makes it more difficult to solve all the other issues that are out there. And I agree with Mr. Perry entirely that if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was resolved tomorrow, the Iranians would still not stop their nuclear program, wouldn't solve many other problems that we have in the region. But I do think what we've seen happen over the past week was the Obama administration seizing on a particular moment that they viewed as a test of their own will. Remember, as Martin said before, the context of this was that the Obama administration attempted last year to get Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government to agree to a broad freeze on settlements. Mm-hmm. Knowing that without that, the negotiations would have a hard time getting started. They ended up backing down from that some in September. And I think that as you talk to people in the White House, they now view that as a mistake, that it was viewed I think, in Israel as a sign that the president could be rolled on these issues. So the president was deeply involved in preparing Vice President Biden's trip. He went through the speech Vice President Biden was going to give line by line. Mm. He had two separate meetings with the vice president on the trip before the vice president left, one the morning that he was leaving. Mm-hmm. And so I think he took the Israeli announcement as a sign of an effort to undermine the core mission of the Biden trip. And that's why they came down so hard. You know, that first statement that Vice President Biden issued the evening that he was having dinner with Prime Minister Netanyahu, just an hour before he had the dinner, mm-hmm. said the United States condemns the action by Israel. That word was put in very deliberately. Condemn is the line that the U.S. uses after the North Koreans shoot off a nuclear test.
Yeah, yeah.
It is not the kind of word that is normally used discussing an ally like
mm-hmm.
Israel.
Mm-hmm. I've got that tape right here. Let's listen to it. This is the vice president. Well, it was last Thursday at Tel Aviv University.
The Israeli government announced it would advance planning for new housing units in East Jerusalem. I realize this is a very touchy subject in Israel as well as my own country, but because that decision, in my view, undermined the trust required for productive negotiations, I, and at the request of the President Obama, condemned it immediately and unequivocally.
The vice president, and here on Meet the Press, a few days later, President Obama's top advisor, David Axelrod, on the Israeli settlement announcement.
This was an affront. It was an insult. But most importantly, it undermined this very fragile effort to bring peace to that region.
This was an affront. This was an insult. Mark Perry, David Sanger looks at this in the Pentagon angle and says, no news here. This has been a status and, you know, understood for a long time. But you write that the January Mullen briefing was unprecedented. In what way?
Well, I agree with my colleagues here that we shouldn't exaggerate this. And I knew when I wrote this piece that this was going to be a controversial piece, but I had no idea it was going to be so explosive. And believe me, it's been explosive. So what's really going on here? And I think that what's going on here is that important people in the policy establishment in Washington would really like to do a reset on this relationship with Israel. Yes, we'll retain our alliance with them, our strong bonds of friendship. I don't doubt that. But our security in the world is not dependent on Israel. Their security is dependent on us. And the metaphor I use is the American-British relationship in World War II. We fought together. We had strong friendships with each other. But we were in charge of the alliance. We were putting the most money on the table. We were putting the most lives on the table. And that was important. And at key moments of World War II, we got our way. And I think that that kind of message wants – that there are people, important policymakers in Washington, who want to send that message to Israel. Listen, we have problems in this region, and it's not just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But you need to be a little bit more sensitive to our concerns. And this Biden visit showed a side to you that it was very insensitive, very lacking in knowledge of the importance of this alliance. Don't surprise us like this again. That message needed to be sent. And that's why I think this piece was so explosive.
If you're right, I don't know if you are, but if you're right, it matters who these important policymakers are. I mean, are these sort of bureaucrats down in the weeds or up at the top? What?
This is the military.
These are senior
military commanders in the Middle East who are increasingly disturbed that the violence is getting worse in the region and that the response to it simply can't be sending another aircraft carrier or sending another division. We're not going to kill our way out of the war on terrorism. Mm-hmm. We're not going to win in Afghanistan by destroying our enemies. This isn't World War II. This is a much more of a twilight struggle. And it's a political struggle. And our partner in that struggle is Israel. And they need to be sensitive to the politics of this. And they don't seem to be.
Martin Indyk, do you see a move in the Pentagon or elsewhere to, in Mark Perry's words, do a reset on this relationship with Israel?
I think that Mark put it very well, and I think the way that he put it applies probably, and David would know better than me, but I think it applies probably to the highest civilian officials as well. But resetting the relationship is depends what you mean by that. If you mean, as Mark described it, that the Israelis understand that our interests are at stake, not just their the survival of their coalition, their right-wing coalition, that American interests are at stake, and they need to take that into account even when a low-level zoning official decides to approve a zoning application in Jerusalem, that kind of reset is very important, and I think that is part of the message that they're trying to send to the Israeli government, and I suspect that Netanyahu finally got it. This happens periodically in the U.S.-Israel relationship because we are like the indulgent father who tends to forgive the wayward son over and over and over again, but until it finally gets to the point where we have to say enough is enough. And I think that's the moment we got to last week.
Let's hear from our listeners. Greenwich, Connecticut. Harold, you're on the air, Harold.
Hi. Years ago, a former congressman wrote a book. I think it was called They Dare to Speak Out. Congressman McCloskey, I think was his name. And in it, it really sort of detailed the influence that the Israeli lobbies had in Washington in terms of influencing policy. In view of what's happened over the past week, does this really, in your mind, evidence a shift in terms of the influence of the lobby in Washington? Or are there other people who, the other speaker was just talking about the defense people, being more in the forefront on this one?
David Sanger, let me go first to you with that. What do you say?
Well, the listener raises a very interesting question, because I think if this had happened 10 years ago, I think that the statements that were made by groups like AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which immediately called on President Obama to go fix the nature of this relationship, I think that would have carried a lot more weight than it did when they turned out their statement last weekend. In fact, the Israel lobby in the United States is now much more split. There are many now within different groups in the United States who argue, I think, and have gathered a lot of adherence to the thought that Israel at times doesn't best understand its own self-interest or, as Martin just said, consider the interests of its major ally, the United States. You know, when I was back in college and first studying political theory, you know, they would send everybody out to read Tocqueville, you know, who wandered America. And, you know, the phrase, that the sort of bumper sticker phrase that comes out of Tocqueville is self-interest well understood, which means understanding over the long term what's in your self-interest. And I think that if there is any reset going on right now with the U.S. and Israel, it is an effort by Washington and an effort by the Obama administration to go back to Tocqueville's self-interest well understood. And I think part of what's going on here is the Israeli government not fully understanding the shift from the Bush administration, which frequently gave acted, I think, what was Martin's phrase, the indulgent father, to the Obama administration, which I think has taken a significantly different view. And I think adjusting to the first year or 14 months of the Obama administration is turning out to be a little harder for the Israelis than they first imagined.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American interests and the blow-up with Israel. Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk is with us. David Sanger, author of The Inheritance and Pulitzer Prize-winning chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, is here. Mark Perry is here. He's written recently in Foreign Policy Magazine Online about the Pentagon's keen interest lately in the cost of the unresolved Israel-Palestinian conflict. Jim, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hello. I'd like to get your guests' reaction to what is apparently a very amateurish approach to the Middle East conflict by the Obama administration. It's even commented on such by Washington Post the other day. So not only is it an amateurish reaction for a policy that's been going on through successive presidential administrations in terms of housing, but has it also given a green light to the Arab Street and Abbas's Fatah party? We've seen in the last 4 days significant violence in Israel with the age-old cry that the Israelis are trying to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque. And secondly, I'd like to know exactly who is informing the Obama administration about policy. For example, Samantha Power is on record advocating the military intervention by U.S. military in the Middle East crisis. Is she got a rather inordinate effect on the Obama administration? Who exactly is informing their policy?
May I just ask you, Jim, before I put it to our panel, what do you mean by amateurish approach?
Well, for example, the housing policy has been going on for years. Admittedly, it was a tactical and timing error, but it's nothing unusual or extraordinary for Israel to build in Jerusalem, especially in areas that don't displace any Palestinians. On the other hand, at the same time that the housing initiative was announced, the Palestinian Authority was commencing to honor a terrorist who had killed 37 civilians in Israel in 1978, obviously a provocation not particularly that drew the attention of the Obama administration.
Jim, let us pick it up right there then. Ambassador Endrick, do you see something amateurish in the Obama administration's handling of this relationship? They've certainly changed from the last one, but amateurish?
Well, I think every administration has a very steep learning curve in its first year. God knows we did in the Clinton administration. And in this particular case, they made a mistake by calling for a full settlements freeze, including natural growth. And then, here's where I think the mistake lay, in then negotiating something less than that, which is what Mitchell did with Netanyahu, without ever adjusting the goal. And as a result, Abu Mazen climbed out on a limb saying, you know, I can't accept less than what the President of the United States is demanding. And when, in fact, we delivered less and Hillary Clinton tried to dress it up as unprecedented, the Palestinians said, well, you know, it's not good enough for us. There has to be a freeze on activity in Jerusalem. And so then we got into the whole Jerusalem game. So, yeah, there was a mistake made that hurt the administration's credibility. But, you know, this is not easy. And given the great mistrust that had grown over the years after the Intifada and the loss of lives on both sides and the real destruction of Palestinian capabilities to be an effective partner, the rise of Hamas, I mean, there's so much has happened over the last 8 years that it's really difficult now to try to get back to where we were at the end of the Clinton administration.
And with the
so you have to take into account degree of difficulty.
Yes, and the urgency that the White House may be hearing from the Pentagon, given everything else that's going on. Thomas in Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Thomas.
Hi. Thanks for taking this call.
Yes.
Well, as a Jew, but also as an American, I'm absolutely outraged at the insult that was given to our government. I think, the president of Israel, because he can blame it on some subordinate, but it was really under his responsibility that the announcement that Israel was going to build these housing developments in East Jerusalem was made. Now, I'm also worried very much that Israel is increasingly arrogant. Yeah, about many things. They also had this incident with the Turkish ambassador, where he was made to sit on a small stool in front of his opposite number, the minister, and the minister towered above him on his desk.
Mm-hmm.
And also, finally, Mr. Netanyahu's announcement that he regards the West Bank as being part of greater Israel.
So what do you think about the notion of a reset, then, in the relationship, Thomas? Is that too much, too far, or not?
Well, no, I think that that we should make the reset and that we should cut dramatically the enormous subsidy that we give to Israel every year.
Thomas, let us pick it up there, and I thank you for your call. I've got a web comment here from David, who says, I'm a Zionist, if only because experience has proven that someone can kill a great fraction of my people and no one else will sufficiently give a damn to do anything about it. That being said, he writes, I welcome this change Israel needs in us, I guess the U.S., a friend of the sort that France was to us, the U.S., before the Iraq debacle, when they were saying, don't go there, don't go to war. And David says, friends don't let friends commit slow suicide. Mark Perry, what do you hear in Thomas's call in our web comment?
I hear discomfort with the Israeli-American relationship. I'll say this. It's, you know, we go back to the magic wand comment of Martin Indyk. You know, there are some things that we can do and should do. But to just condemn and take $6 billion out of the budget or $3 billion or lecture the prime minister of Israel is probably not going to be a solution. He is the head of a very difficult coalition in Israel, and I'm sure he's looking over his shoulder at that coalition every second. And there are some things that he can and can't do. At the same time, who's going to be able to deliver a credible progress on the peace process? It seems to me it's probably not going to be a liberal or a left-wing Israeli prime minister. They're going to have the same kind of problems that Netanyahu can. But Mr. Netanyahu can do things here and can make progress. There are steps that he can take. And he should be able to take them.
David Sanger, do you see a reset, or do you hear the conversation of a reset going on in the Washington you cover?
Well, you know, reset and the reset button was a phrase coined by the Obama administration in discussing what needed to be done with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that phrase used, save here this morning, in regard to Israel. But clearly a readjustment of attitudes and a reassessment of long-term interests is part of the game here, and I think you're seeing that happen. I also suspect, based on my own conversations with members of the administration, that they are trying to force Prime Minister Netanyahu to make a choice. As Mark pointed out, it's a very fragile coalition in which the Prime Minister is quite beholden to a sort of right-wing bloc that has very much pressed the issue that there would be no movement on settlements. And I think what the Obama administration is trying to do is make is get Prime Minister Netanyahu out of the middle lanes of this, where he leans one way and the other, and in fact make a choice to go in the direction the White House wants him to go. Now, you know, Martin would be a much better judge of this than I am, but I suspect if this administration had its druthers, they would rather see that coalition reorganized in a way that made Prime Minister Netanyahu much more dependent on the opposition party, the Kadima party, Tipna Livni, and reform the coalition that way. But I don't think Washington's got that choice. So I think that's part of the pressure that you're seeing take place.
Let's go to Alan in Memphis, Tennessee. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is this. Over the course of our history, it's been emphasized that the U.S. and Israel have a solid alliance and a special relationship. In fact, that's been emphasized in the course of this conversation. On the other hand, it's also been said that the United States is the only effective third party, the only neutral ombudsman for mediating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. My question is, aren't these two roles fundamentally at odds? How can we be both the solid ally of one party and the neutral third party that mediates the conflict?
Ambassador Indyk, that sounds like your terrain.
Well, we don't claim to be the neutral mediator. The whole point is that Israel holds the critical cards necessary to resolve the conflict, the territorial cards, the control over Jerusalem, that have to be played in order to resolve the conflict. The Palestinians have very few cards in their hands except the no card and the yes card. And therefore, they turn to us and all the Arabs from Anwar Sadat on, the former Egyptian president, the late Egyptian president, have turned to the United States to use our influence with Israel to get it to play those cards. And that's the critical thing. Anwar Sadat said famously that the United States gives Israel everything from a loaf of bread to a phantom jet, the weapon of the day. Mm. And that's why I'm going to Washington. And that remains the case today, that for all the ideas about European mediation, UN mediation, and so on, the Arabs understand that if they want to address their grievances through negotiations, the address is Washington, because Washington has the ability to influence Israel. Therefore, it's not a matter of being even-handed or being neutral, as the caller suggests. It's a matter of using the influence that we have effectively to produce a resolution of the conflict. In order to do that, we have to do something which is counterintuitive to most of the people who are listening on this question, which is we have to ensure that Israel feels secure, because it's the one that we're asking to take tangible risks for peace. And that's why Secretary Clinton and President Obama keep on saying, we're not talking about Israel's security. That's why Biden went there, the vice president, to say, we're committed to your security. We're going to stand by you. But we're also asking you to take calculated risks for peace. And it's that part of the equation that Netanyahu is very reluctant to do, for the reasons that we've discussed. He has a right-wing coalition. He can do it because he's a right-wing leader, just like Nixon went to China. He will get the support of the center and the left. The question is, does he have the will to do it? Does he have the courage to do it? And that's what, underneath it all, this moment is about, where Obama and Hillary are basically saying, Bibi, you need to get serious about this. Are you with us, or are you against us? And if you're with us, we can work together very effectively. But if you're going to play around with a housing unit here and a settlement there, then we've got a big problem.
Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air, Laura. What do you think?
Oh, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I attend a church where the grandparents of Rachel Corrie, they attend my church, and Rachel Corrie was a peace activist that went to Rafah to protest homes being demolished, and she was crushed by a caterpillar driven by an Israeli military guy. And I just think it's interesting that here we are today, 7 years later, and, you know, people that would like to go back to Israel and that are Palestinian cannot. I mean, that's pretty much been decided. But people there who are having children, and the population is growing, albeit slowly probably compared to the Israelis, where are they going to live? And I think that this has been a real slap in the face, and maybe the Obama administration needs to get a backbone and stand up to Netanyahu. And I think there's a lot of people that do support that here in the United States.
Laura, we hear it. Let me get another call. Our time is short. Thank you for yours. Newton, Massachusetts, Greg. Our time is short, Greg, but you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to make a comment. I think the tail's been wagging the dog for way too long. Your guest statement that Israel holds the cards, they don't hold the cards. We do. We're supporting them tremendously, and we ought to use that power. They have totally ignored our request for them to restrain in building on the West Bank for many years, not just recently and not just with this slap in the face, but they've done it repeatedly.
So turn it around. We've got it. We've got the perspective. One more. Uvale in Rockville, Maryland. Thank you, Greg. Uvale, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I suppose the question is, why does the U.S. have such little leverage with respect to Israel policy, considering the U.S. provides over $2 billion direct aid, and these $2 billion should theoretically give the U.S. tremendous power to shape the development of Israel policies? What I see is U.S. president's hands are tied. Cut in subsidies are extremely unlikely as a result of AIPAC's power in the Senate. AIPAC power that, as a result, ties the hands of U.S. politicians is a reason why no progress takes place over and over of the past decade.
Yuval, are you Israeli, Palestinian? What?
My mom is Israeli, and I've spent a lot of time as a child there. I love the country, but I believe that Israel has become a spoiled child because there's no restraints on how much, you know, support is given by the states, and as a result, they believe they can act in whatever way they want.
Yuval, we're up against the clock here. Mark Perry, do you see a new understanding here of American interests emerging? Or, you know, is it as Martin Indyk says, there's a relationship, and that relationship is necessary for progress to take place?
I agree that I think the word here is readjustment. We are in the middle of a readjustment, and it can be painful and uncertain and uncomfortable, especially with such a close friend as Israel. We need to keep one thing in mind with the Israeli lobby. The head of AIPAC can call the President of the United States. Maybe the President will take the call, or maybe not. But when the head of the military calls the President of the United States, the President picks up the telephone. And that's the issue here. When you have somebody like General Petraeus or his staff or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or whoever it is, a senior military officer, evidencing real discomfort with the lack of progress in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, people pay attention. And we're going to find out, I think, in the next few days whether Mr. Netanyahu is paying attention. And the answer to that question is key.
David Sanger, of course, there's the outstanding request from Washington that the 1,600 units be disapproved. How much hinges on that, David? Do we just roll on?
Well, I think a fair bit does. And I think the interesting question here is what leverage does the United States have if Prime Minister Netanyahu does not respond to that request? That was one of several requests. One of the other requests that Secretary Clinton made was that he truly engage in these proximity talks, these indirect talks. But leverage is hard to come by in these relationships, and I think President Obama is coming to terms with that.
David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. It's always great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us today, David.
Thank you.
Ambassador Martin Indyk, now Vice President at the Brookings Institution. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for being with us today.
And thank you, Tom.
And Mark Perry, who sort of lobbed the little grenade here, not so little, in Foreign Policy magazine. Mark Perry, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for your calls and comments. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.